Welcome to this episode of Live from Lord North Street. I'm Emily Carver, Media Manager at the IEA. This month marks the centenary of one of the most radical public health initiatives ever undertaken in a democratic society. On January the 17th, 1920, the Volstead Act came into effect in the United States. The Act, named after Republican politician Andrew Volstead, was enacted to carry out the intent of the 18th Amendment. This established the nationwide prohibition on the manufacture, sale, and transportation of intoxicating liquors in the United States. For over a decade, America engaged in what was then called a noble experiment. But the outcomes were so painfully disastrous that by 1933, the US had repealed the amendment, ending the increasingly unpopular prohibition. This was the first and only time in US history that a constitutional amendment has been rescinded. The IEA's Director General, Mark Littlewood, referred to prohibition in his piece for the Times as the standout example of how heavy-handed state regulation can lead to appalling public health outcomes. The experiment was deemed a total failure, not least because it provoked social unrest, corruption, and organized crime. Indeed, prohibition helped gangster Al Capone establish himself as a top dog in the mafia world, where he made $1.4 billion a year in today's money. While there are few voices in Britain calling for a return to criminalising alcohol, prohibition still exists today in different guises. Governments continue to impose unnecessary quasi-bans on a range of items, from sugary drinks to cigarettes and drugs. Only this month have the government announced a ban on gambling with credit cards. So, should we be concerned about where this type of paternalistic intervention is leading us, and what, if anything, can we do about it? Our guest here today is Christopher Snowden. Christopher is the head of lifestyle economics at the IEA and is the author of a range of books and publications, including The Art of Suppression, The Crack Cocaine of Gambling, and Killjoys, a Critique of Paternalism. He has also written extensively on the topic of prohibition and how he thinks it is contributing to the growth of a rather terrifying nanny state in this country. Welcome, Chris.
Hi.
So, Chris, we generally think of the USA as the land of the free. So how on earth did America end up banning alcohol in the first place?
Well, it wasn't just America, for a start. A lot of people don't realise that you also had prohibition around about the same time in Finland, in Norway, in Russia.
Really? I had no idea.
Russia, yeah. Lenin got rid of that in the 1920s to make the workers a bit more happy. The Faroe Islands didn't repeal prohibition until 1992.
Wow.
Iceland didn't repeal prohibition on beer until 1989. But most of them got rid of prohibition around about the same time as America, mid-1930s. How did it happen in America? It was a funny sequence of events in some respect, like a lot of things in history. The campaign for prohibition had been going on for about 100 years before it actually happened. The amount of alcohol being consumed in America, and indeed in Britain actually, but in America specifically, in the late 18th, early 19th century, was off the scale compared to what people consume these days. You think you have a binge drinking culture these days, it's nothing compared to how much people used to drink. You see it on a graph, it's scarcely believable. And as a response to that, partially, you had a temperance movement emerging in the 1820s. Again, you had the same thing in Britain and other countries. And the temperance movement, which literally was just about temperance, moderation, very quickly turned into a prohibitionist movement or a teetotal movement. Then in, I think, the 1870s, it's been a few years since I studied this, so I might be slightly wrong on some of the dates, but I think in the 1870s you had the Women's March in Ohio, in which a load of housewives got sick of their husbands coming back from the pub with no money. And there were undoubted problems associated with alcohol, as there always will be, but I mean, certainly at that time there were problems of secondary poverty, domestic violence, and so on. And that then turned into the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is an organized society, started in Ohio and then went nationwide. And as the name suggests, their main thing, although they had other policy objectives, their main thing was temperance and prohibition. You had a prohibition party set up a little bit later on. But it was really the formation of the Anti-Saloon League, which I think was in the early 1890s, they more or less invented pressure politics, actually. It's very interesting. They went about things very differently to the Prohibition Party, which was kind of like your Libertarian Party, something mm-hmm. like a complete no-hope organization operating in what was essentially a two-party system. They instead put immense pressure on individual candidates to endorse a particular policy, in this instance, local prohibition. They were pretty smart about it. They were mainly supported by people from the various churches, particularly the kind of Protestant churches. And they would get politicians to pledge to introduce prohibition, regardless of whether the politician himself was a teetotaler or a drinker. It didn't really matter to them. They were fairly cynical and pragmatic about it. And bit by bit, local prohibitions and statewide prohibitions started to grow. Some of them actually were repealed. I mean, the very first one was in the early 1850s in Maine. A bit of trivia for you. Manchester City's old ground used to be called Main Road. It's on Main Road in Manchester. Main Road is called Main Road because it was named after Maine, and it was named after Maine because it was the first state in America to go dry. Oh. And there was quite a big prohibitionist movement in Manchester at that time. So you had various states had gone dry, various towns and cities had gone dry. Then you had the First World War, and the First World War probably pushed the prohibition movement over the winning line for a number of reasons, one of which was that there were temporary restrictions on alcohol and the use of land in particular for growing crops for alcohol as a kind of temporary wartime measure. But also because the Germans suddenly became very unpopular in America because of the First World War. And it was the German brewers who had been doing the most to kind of campaign and lobby against prohibition. And for those reasons and several others, you then finally got the Prohibition Amendment, the 18th Amendment pushed through. And it was then ratified and came into effect, as you say, in January 1920. And it's not only the only amendment to be repealed, as you rightly say, it's also the only amendment that takes freedom away from people. Of all the constitutional amendments, it's the only one that removes freedom.
That's really interesting. So it's broadly accepted, I guess, that prohibition in America at least had noble aims. To reduce crime, as you said, there was domestic violence, and to help improve public health. Why don't you continue by outlining why prohibition in America didn't work, despite these worthy aims?
Well, firstly, I'm not sure there were worthy aims. It really depends on your perspective. I mean, okay. It was a profoundly illiberal measure. And people have written some very interesting books looking at prohibition through the wider sociological lens and seeing it as actually not being entirely about alcohol at all. It was almost a culture war, actually. You could, if you were pushed to, you could draw parallels with Brexit. It was it was a city against the towns. It was recent immigrants against older immigrants. There were a lot of different things going on there, and you can't even assume that everybody who supported prohibition was a teetotaler either. There were plenty of people who were drinkers but just didn't want certain other people to be drinking, and certainly not drinking a great deal. I mean, you've got to remember, the main organisation to push for prohibition, as I say, is the Anti-Saloon League. Mm-hmm. And the name of that itself is quite telling. It wasn't the Anti-Alcohol League. It wasn't the Anti-Beer League. It was the Anti-Saloon League. And they genuinely were mostly concerned about the saloons. The old school saloons, which no longer really exist, partially because of prohibition, were seen as real dens of iniquity. They were very, very male-dominated. You had all the port barrel politics of America going through the saloons. They were overwhelmingly urban. They were very largely populated by fairly recent immigrants. And prohibition didn't actually stop people brewing their own cider, for example. So people out in the countryside who wanted to make their own cider, as they had been doing for centuries, were perfectly free to do so. it didn't really stop people with a bit of money from drinking. You know, I think there's parallels here with minimum pricing. You know, people who support minimum pricing are not all teetotalers by any means. They just want certain people to stop drinking. And when we say certain people, we mean people on lower incomes. So there was...
There was a large snobbish aspect to it.
There was a large cultural aspect to it. So I don't think it was particularly noble. And coming from somebody, you know, who... values personal liberty, I don't think anything like this can ever be seen as noble. However, I will give you the fact that there were clearly problems with alcohol, and no doubt there were problems with the saloons in early 20th century America. And if they hoped simply to make people more responsible for their money and reduce secondary poverty and reduce domestic violence and street violence, and you know, they are indeed noble aims, I'll give you that. Why didn't it actually happen like that? Well, in fairness, to some extent it did. It would be wrong to say that there were no benefits came from prohibition whatsoever. You did see an initial very large drop in the sale of alcohol, as you might expect. Some of that, admittedly, was down to people stockpiling before the event. There was one club, I think, in Harvard, famously bought enough alcohol to last it 14 years. Not knowing, of course, it was only going to last 14 years. It was just a happy coincidence. But yeah, alcohol consumption did fall. Liver cirrhosis rates didn't actually fall during prohibition, it seems, but they did fall in the kind of 20 years beforehand when there were a lot of statewide prohibitions. And there is evidence that those statewide prohibitions, at least, did have a positive effect on certain alcohol-related diseases. So it wasn't all bad news. However, you've got to balance that on the other side of the ledger with everything else that prohibition brought about. It brought about, as you say, organised crime at a level that never had been seen before. It was effectively the start of the mafia. And yes, the mafia continued after prohibition, but that's only because they found other things to get into. Fortunately for them, around about the same time as America was banning alcohol, it was also banning all the drugs. So there's always been a product for the mafia to sell. But the murder rate rose throughout prohibition. It peaked in 1933, the year that prohibition ended, and it fell precipitously thereafter. Suicide rates, interestingly, rose throughout prohibition and fell round about the time that prohibition was repealed. The liver cirrhosis rate that had been falling beforehand didn't fall thereafter. There are people, and there are a few academic studies making the case that actually prohibition was a success. You know, it's a kind of contrarian galaxy brain take, is to say, well, actually everything you think you know about prohibition is wrong. David Aronovich made this case a few months ago in the Times. It doesn't stack up. You can't sincerely, I think, you know, in full view of the facts, say that it was a success. You can acknowledge that there were certain benefits to prohibition if you're totally, if you have total tunnel vision about per capita alcohol consumption and certain alcohol-related diseases, you can see a silver lining, but the cloud is much bigger. You saw the birth of organised crime, you saw homicide rates going up, you saw massive disrespect for the law, you saw tax take going down, and you saw also, as I think she's called Lisa McGurr, she wrote a book called The War on Alcohol a few years ago. She very interestingly points to prohibition as being the birth of the modern American police state, effectively. This law normalized police raids on people's homes at a level that never been seen before. It revived the Ku Klux Klan in the southern states of America. It was the birth of the FBI. There were lots of things that were very negative about prohibition, which we still feel today. And even after repeal, the full apparatus of the police state was directed towards drugs instead of alcohol. So there are so many things, so many negative things that prohibition did that I don't think anyone can seriously claim it was a success. And that's even before we get to the thousands and thousands of people who died from drinking moonshine. It was poisoned generally by methanol, but in many cases poisoned deliberately by the US government.
You mentioned David Aronovich's op-ed in the Times.
I read it too. Do you think that, well, we still see commentators still talking about the virtues of prohibition, saying that, you know, there were the plus sides of it. Do you think that we can say that we've truly learned the lessons from prohibition? Do you think that governments are still willing to curtail individual liberty and personal responsibility?
No, clearly not, as anyone who reads the newspapers can see. I mean, I actually think that in some ways, the not only have the lessons of prohibition not been learnt, but we're not looking at prohibition in the right way to start with. The discussion about whether prohibition worked or not starts from a false premise, which is that had the authorities had the ability and the power to enforce prohibition so that almost everybody obeyed it, it would have been a success. And you can only say that, I think, from either a technocratic or a deeply illiberal position. The biggest problem with prohibition wasn't any of the things I've already mentioned, as bad as they were. It was the fact that it stopped people doing something that they like, something that improves their lives, something that maximizes their utility, as economists would say. That in itself is reason enough to oppose prohibition. It seems obvious now in retrospect that there were way too many people drinking alcohol in 1920 for prohibition ever to work in the sense of being obeyed and respected. But even if there had only been 5% of the population drinking, and it was possible with the full use of the state apparatus to bring them into line and imprison enough of them to encourage the others, it still, I think, would have been a foul and despicable policy. We certainly haven't learned the lesson of that. We still have illiberal policies being praised on the basis that people obey them. Mm-hmm. The smoking ban. People will say, well, you know, people oppose a smoking ban, but everyone obeys it now. Well, yeah, they do obey it. We're generally a law-abiding country. It doesn't make it in itself a good policy. And as for the other unintended consequences, no, we haven't learned the lessons from them either. The word prohibition has so much stigma around it these days that generally prohibitionists will avoid it. In the field of tobacco control, they'll tend to use the euphemism endgame. It's barely euphemistic, really. It means exactly the same thing. Theresa May, in the dying days of her government, decided that Britain was going to go smoke-free by 2030. That seems to be a euphemism for prohibition, as far as I can tell. It means the eradication of cigarettes. Can't see how you can do that without prohibition or even attempt to. And the other policies that are not overtly prohibitionistic, what we might call neo-prohibition policies, things like putting up the tax so much that a product becomes unaffordable for a lot of people, and other milder prohibitions, restricting advertising, restricting licensing, all with all with the aim of deterring people from mm-hmm. from buying a particular product or engaging in a particular activity. These all have negative consequences that are only different to the consequences of prohibition by degree. So you can put up the price of a bottle of whiskey or a pack of cigarettes by hundreds of a percent, and we do in this country, hundreds of a percent. It doesn't lead to Al Capone kind of levels of black market activity, but we have a very large black market, not only in tobacco, but also alcohol in this country. And it's overwhelmingly due to sin taxes. You know, John Stuart Mill pointed out 150 years ago that the difference between prohibition and putting up the price of something with the deliberate intent of deterring purchase is only one degree. You know, you're still effectively prohibiting certain people from buying it. And what happens when you do that?
With tobacco, I've read that people aren't actually buying their cigarettes in the UK anymore. They're getting them from elsewhere. Black market growing here, and that's less tax for the government anyway.
Yeah, even by its own figures, the government loses about £3 or 4 billion, I think, in tax from tobacco. And I think its own figures are a little bit on the optimistic side. Certainly it would be interesting to see what happens after Brexit if we don't get some kind of decent duty-free deal. But yeah, I mean, the point is people will turn to the black market when you give them incentive to do so. If you completely ban the sale of a product, as we've done with cannabis, mm-hmm. as the Americans did with alcohol, then you have no choice whatsoever other than going on the black market. If you whack up the price to such an extent that you're being ripped off and exploited, then that is still a pretty big incentive to go on the black market. And you get all the problems that you see in America in terms of the product being not regulated and therefore adulterated in many cases, and funding a huge criminal network and the loss of tax revenue.
Well, that was going to be my next question, was going to be, you've written a lot of articles, you've spoken a lot about the legalization of cannabis. Mark talked about how the modern day equivalent of alcohol prohibition is the war on drugs. We've seen similar consequences to those suffered in America in the 20s. Drug consumption remains widespread. Products are more dangerous than they otherwise would be. Violent criminals are enriching themselves by organizing supply, and the burden on the police and the courts is enormous. Why do you think it's so important that we move to liberalize law on drugs?
Because we've got exactly the same problems as they had under prohibition. And in a way, it goes back to my point that, you know, prohibition would still be wrong even if a few percent of the population were drinking. Mm-hmm. Well, only a few percent of the population take drugs. A slightly larger percent, I guess, for cannabis in America, but still it's a pretty small minority, whereas drinkers were a small majority. And you can't, as a matter of practical politics, impose prohibition when most people are consuming the product, even if quite a large number of them are prepared to look the other way. But because drug users are a small minority in most cases, they've managed to allow prohibition to persist for over 100 years. You know, the Harrison Tax Act on cannabis, on opium, 1915, I think. The bans on other drugs all took place in the 1920s during Prohibition, and America got the rest of the world to follow suit through the League of Nations and latterly the United Nations. And I think it's a big problem for legalizers like myself, because you just haven't got enough people who are directly affected who are going to do anything about it. Things are looking a bit more positive with cannabis these days, probably because it's considered to be the mildest of the illicit drugs, and also because more people consume cannabis than do cocaine or heroin. But it has enormously increased the risk of taking these products. And if you look at things at the individual level, as I do, rather than the population level, as people in public health do, then it is abhorrent that the risk to the individual of consuming these products has been hugely, hugely increased by prohibition. We now have in England, Wales and Scotland the highest rate of drug mortality on record. Scotland has the highest rate of drug mortality by far in Europe. There are more people now dying from illicit drugs in Scotland than are dying from alcohol.
Really?
It's an astonishing statistic. You have a legal drug, which everyone accepts carries risks, alcohol, which is killing fewer people than drugs that have been illegal for a century.
Wow. Well, you've been described by the BBC as ultra-libertarian. Why do you think so many people don't share the view that you do? Why do you think there's such a tendency towards these paternalistic attitudes? Do you think there's some sort of, psychologically, there's a reason why politicians are so quick to propose these kind of interventions? Do you think it comes from a place of goodwill, or perhaps it's a little more sinister?
I wouldn't use the word sinister as such. I just think that people are prone to panicking about things that they really shouldn't be panicking about. They don't see the long sweep of history. They don't see that very often things are actually getting better. You take problem gambling as an example. You mentioned earlier on the new prohibition. In the gambling space with credit cards, it's not something I care passionately about, I must say, but nevertheless, there is a growing moral panic about gambling. And yet, if you just look at the statistics, which came out December last year, no press coverage from them whatsoever, and I suspect there was no press coverage from them because they showed that problem gambling rates are at their lowest on record. Drug-related deaths, highest on record. Problem gambling, lowest on record. You know, which one are we actually trying to do something about? And there is... There is a constant sequence of panics about various different things, and they're all chopped up into little bite-sized pieces. I think that's the thing, you know. If in 1870 or 1820 the teetotal movement had been totally open about exactly what they wanted to do and what the consequences would be, nobody would ever have gone along with it. I mean, it was a big surprise actually to a lot of people when Prohibition came in how harsh the Volstead Act was. They didn't know what they were voting for. They still assumed, a lot of people still assumed they'd be allowed to buy beer, for example. But when the Act came in, the only beer you could get was 0.5% beer. So if the anti-smoking people had laid out their full agenda in 1980, I don't think people would have gone along with it. Same with the alcohol people probably today. But it's all chopped up into little bits. And we just came, we just need this little prohibition here, this little ban here, because we have this huge problem. And then you point out a year or two later that the problem is still as huge as it's ever been and that their policy didn't make any difference. And they just say, oh, well, we need a whole systems approach, you see. obviously, one little thing can't make any difference. It's no silver bullet. And you think, well, that's not really the impression you gave us at the time when you were going wild about how absolutely indispensable this policy, you know, was for you, and how Parliament was throwing thousands of children's lives under the bus if they didn't introduce it immediately.
As you said, Theresa May's government was pretty keen on banning things. To end the podcast, do you think there's anything we can be positive about with the new government under Boris Johnson's leadership?
Well, I was on one of these podcasts fairly positive about Theresa May's leadership. It's something I don't like to talk about. But I try and see the best in people, Emily, you know. I don't know. Nobody really knows where Boris stands on this. I was a spectator reader when he was the editor. Read a lot of his articles in the Telegraph and the Spectator at the time, and he always seemed to me to be both a libertine and a libertarian. But who really knows? Everyone keeps pointing out to me that he banned drinking on the tube and he had a sugar tax in City Hall. And this certainly doesn't look good from my perspective. I think his heart's basically in the right place. But in a way, you know, how much does it matter even what the Prime Minister thinks? You know, it's not like he can just wish this away. There is a huge bank of people in very powerful influential positions, not least Public Health England, who would need to be fought pretty hard for this stuff not to keep happening. And you might say, well, he's the Prime Minister, can do what he wants. Well, not really. I mean, all politicians have a certain amount of capital and they use it up where they want to use it up. I'm not sure he's going to necessarily want to use it up fighting the nanny statists. I hope I'm wrong. I don't think things will get significantly worse under Johnson, but I have said that before and I've been wrong.
Well, we'll see. Well, thank you for speaking to us today, Chris, and thank you for lending us your insight. To our listeners, let us know what you think by tweeting us at IEA London.